Welcome back, listeners, once again, to another installment of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and today's show is going to hit some topics that people have been curious about. One very popular topic is polygraphs. People want to get an explanation of polygraphs and why they're not admissible. Well, ask and ye shall receive. We're also going to discuss the right and wrong way for law enforcement to conduct an identification procedure and the ethical responsibilities of prosecutors. Now, this episode is unique in that there was ultimately no trial in this case for us to look at. The charges against David Evans, Colin Finnerty, and Reed Seligman were dismissed prior to trial, and the three were declared factually innocent by the Attorney General. But there's still a wealth of interesting legal issues we can examine through looking at the following facts. Evans, Finnerty, and Seligman were student athletes at Duke University in 2006. They played lacrosse, where Duke University is a perennial powerhouse. As lacrosse is a spring sport, the team mandated that all players would have to stay on campus over spring break. As a consolation, the team threw a party on March 13, 2006, which involved hiring two exotic dancers to entertain the team members. One of the women would later claim that she was raped by multiple members of the lacrosse team, which sparked a highly criticized investigation and ultimately led to the first ever disbarment of a North Carolina county prosecutor. This is the Duke University rape case, North Carolina versus David Evans, Colin Finnerty, and Reed Seligman. We can dispense with a lot of the intricate background analysis of this case. There were three defendants, and for our purposes, all you really need to know is that Evans, Finnerty, and Seligman were more or less the quintessential Division I college lacrosse stereotype. They came from fairly affluent families, they were white, they may have caused a bit of mischief in their short lives, but none of them had ever been accused of any serious wrongdoing. But they were what we would all consider privileged. In March of 2006, Evans was one of the four captains of the lacrosse team at Duke. Finnerty and Seligman, both sophomores, played attack and midfielder. Now, starting around the mid-1990s, Duke had really become a powerhouse in NCAA lacrosse. In 2005, they had finished as the NCAA Division I runner-up, and things were looking good in the 2006 season as it began. Now, since college lacrosse is played in the spring, there were games and practices scheduled straight through the month of March. As a result, the players on the lacrosse and every other spring sports team stayed on campus during spring break. Recognizing that losing the ability to go on spring break in college is quite a concession, the team captains decided to throw a big party for the players during the week without classes. Since school facilities were closed for the week, after practice on the morning of March 13, 2006, lacrosse coach Mike Pressler handed each student $500 to cover their own meals for the 8 days that campus was effectively shut down. The players naturally decided to use a portion of that money to throw a big party. As a surprise for the players, the captains also contacted an escort company called Allure and requested that two strippers come and attend the party. The players were unaware that this was taking place until they arrived and were asked to chip in money for exotic entertainment. So let's go through first the details of that night that have been undisputed. Allure sent two strippers to the party, which was housed at 610 North Buchanan Boulevard. They were Crystal Gale Magnum and Kim Mira Roberts. Magnum was a student at North Carolina Central University, while Roberts was a full-time exotic dancer and entertainer. Magnum and Roberts arrived separately to 610 North Buchanan. Roberts drove herself, while Magnum was dropped off. Magnum admits that prior to coming to the party, she had been consuming alcohol and taken prescription muscle relaxers. And there was also, obviously, ample amounts of alcohol being served at the party. Most of the accounts that I've come across agree that some of the lacrosse players were rude and obnoxious to Magnum and Roberts when they arrived, which naturally was met with hostility. Shortly into their performance, the two women locked themselves in one of the bathrooms and subsequently left the house. A different group of players approached them on the front lawn and apologized. They promised to behave and convinced Magnum and Roberts to come back into the house. Here is where the accounts start to differ. The following is how Magnum describes what happened next. She claimed that after agreeing to go back into the house, she and Roberts were forcefully separated. She says that she was then dragged into a bathroom where she was raped, beaten, and choked for roughly 30 minutes while her attackers laughed and invited others to join. She claims that she struggled and fought back, that she scratched and clawed her attackers and caused several injuries during the ordeal. Magnum claims that when they were finished, she met back up with Roberts. The two had another verbal altercation with players in front of the house. And shortly before 1 a.m., Roberts made a 911 call claiming that she had been the victim of bigoted and derogatory speech at the address of the party, but failed to mention any sexual assault. After Magnum and Roberts parted ways, Magnum wound up at the Duke University Medical Center claiming to have been raped. The police were contacted and an investigation began. Magnum and Roberts each made a statement, though only Magnum accused anyone of sexual assault. Magnum is eventually asked during the course of the investigation to pick out who attacked her from a photo array. She picks Finnerty and Seligman initially, and then later also identifies Evans. This leads to all three ultimately being arrested and charged with rape, sexual assault, and kidnapping. Now let's get into how the players talk about what happened. Evans, Finnerty, and Seligman gave the same basic account, so rather than give three similar accounts, I'll just provide you with the basics of what they said and let you know where each individual makes a specific claim. Everyone agrees that after some words were exchanged, initiated by one of the players who perhaps had had too much to drink, Magnum and Roberts locked themselves in a bathroom, then left the house, were apologized to, and later came back in. Finnerty and Seligman both agree that they were at the party initially, but they both claim that they left 610 North Buchanan Boulevard during the time period where Magnum and Roberts first locked themselves in the bathroom. They claim they have no knowledge of the woman even leaving the house, coming back in, or anything that happened after that. Evans, who lived at the house, stated that after Magnum and Roberts came back inside, they were approached again by the same player who had caused the initial problem. They returned and locked themselves in a bathroom again. At that point, Evans started directing people to leave, worrying that the loud music at that time of night might cause the neighbors to call the police. Evans also claimed that when Magnum and Roberts came out of the bathroom the second time, they argued briefly with a few of the players who were left in the now mostly empty house, and they left without further incident. The door was locked, and the residents of the house all went to sleep. Evans claimed no one was awake to hear when the police came later that night in response to Roberts' 911 call. The police paperwork indicated that officers responded to the house, but that nobody answered the door and the lights were all off. The following day, on the way to practice, some players noted that there was a police car parked in front of 610 North Buchanan. But it would not be for another few days before any players learned from Coach Pressler that Magnum had accused anybody of rape. As I record this, March 2006 was exactly 15 years ago. Now, that's a long time. But this case was an immediate national story. So I bet that the majority of the listeners old enough to remember 2006 will recall reading and hearing a lot about this situation as it unfolded. It was sex and violence. It was affluent, entitled athletes being accused of treating a woman struggling to make ends meet like an object. It was portrayed as a demonstration of the way college athletes felt they could do whatever they wanted, with no repercussions and no accountability. The media covered the case extensively from the moment they caught wind of the allegations and investigation. So now let's get into that investigation and learn what law enforcement learned and when they learned it, because that became a major issue in how this all unfolded. Once the players were made aware of the investigation, the police requested DNA samples from all members of the team except one. Devin Sherwood was not asked to provide a DNA sample because he was the lone African-American member of the team, and Magnum had claimed that all of her attackers were white. Initially, several of the players, including Evans, Finnerty, and Seligman, offered to take a polygraph, but the police declined to take them up on this. Polygraphs are interesting for a number of reasons. Most people understand the basics of how they work. The subject is hooked up to a machine, which measures reactions to questions through blood pressure, heart rate, breathing, and sweat glands. A baseline is first established by asking a series of questions where the answers are known. Questions like, is your name Matthew Kahn? Is today Tuesday? Or is the current president Joseph Biden? The idea is that when a person is being deceptive, they exhibit changes to the sympathetic nervous system in ways that are recorded but cannot be helped, and that will disrupt the baseline. All questions are given in a yes or no format, so there's no ability to talk around or talk through answers. It's important to note that only one issue can really be covered in each individual polygraph exam. And more or less three questions, or the same question asked in three different ways, can be asked. Anything beyond that will tend to skew the results. Polygraphs are admissible in a few civil jurisdictions, but not in criminal courts. While examiners will swear that a well-administered polygraph test has a over 90% accuracy rate, criminal courts have never held that the results are scientific or reliable enough to admit. And that's because there is simply not enough accepted literature to establish them as an accepted scientific tool. But they are still frequently relied on during investigations as they give law enforcement a way to confront potential suspects who they believe are being deceptive. Well, despite the offers, law enforcement never took any of the players up on taking a polygraph. 46 Duke lacrosse players were then taken to the police station, where they were swabbed for DNA, which they all voluntarily participated in. Then they were all made to strip down to their underwear and photographed, because Magnum had said that she had scratched and clawed her attackers. So the police were looking for any lacerations, bruises, or other physical signs of that particular type of struggle. Not a single player had markings of the kind described by Magnum. The police then assured all 46 players that when the DNA results came back negative, this would all be over. But before any DNA results were returned, the police did land on something which piqued their interest. Around 2 a.m. on the night of the party, another player named Ryan McFadden sent an email to the rest of the lacrosse team, which became an integral part of the investigation's early phase. I'm going to read the first paragraph of the email, but it does contain a small amount of inappropriate language. So if you have young kids with you, or if you're listening in the car with children, you might want to skip forward 30 seconds. Okay. The email says, "To whom it may concern, tomorrow night, after tonight's show, I've decided to have some strippers over to Eden's 2C. All are welcome. However, there will be no nudity. I plan on killing the bitches as soon as they walk in and proceeding to cut off their skin while coming in my Duke issue spandex. All in, besides Arch and Tack, please respond." Arch and Tack were two other Duke University lacrosse teammates. This email became hugely important as 2 weeks after the party, it was sent via Crime Stoppers to the police. The investigators took the email to the Durham County District Attorney, Mike Nifong, who obtained a search warrant on the grounds that he had probable cause to suspect that McFadden had engaged in conspiracy to commit murder. Fans of contemporary American literature or Christian Bale will immediately recognize that the email is a parody of how the anti-hero Patrick Bateman speaks in the Bret Easton Ellis novel American Psycho. Other players immediately caught the reference and responded by offering to bring a Phil Collins or Whitney Houston compact disc to the event. But the responses were not provided to investigators, just the original email. That email was subsequently leaked to the press and brought national condemnation to the Duke lacrosse team. Police then tore through McFadden's small dorm room for well over 6 hours. At the end, they took three $20 bills, two laptops, a camera, a hard drive, two DVDs, an empty backpack, and a pencil-drawn picture of a male reproductive organ on scrap paper. Long before the search was conducted, Magnum had failed to identify McFadden as an attacker. Less than a week later, in a history of labor relations class that McFadden was taking with several teammates, the professor began the class by addressing the allegations. The professor told the class that certain things had been established as facts based on the investigation. First, that intercourse had taken place. Second, that a condom had been used. At this point, several of the cross team members got up and walked out of the class, telling the professor on the way out that they would not be lectured as to facts which did not exist. By April 2006, the campus and the country was in a fervor. More than 500 students, faculty members, and city residents marched through campus for a Take Back the Night rally. They demanded that the lacrosse team be completely disbanded and that all students who played lacrosse be expelled. The event coincided with Sexual Assault Prevention Week. And despite being vilified during the event, several members of the team were quoted in the school paper saying that they supported the event and the underlying meaning. They just expressed regret that they were being targeted for something that they did not do. So let's discuss how, of the 47 members of the Duke lacrosse team, David Evans, Colin Finnerty, and Reed Seligman were singled out and arrested. Frequently, when a person is attacked in some way by somebody that he or she does not know, the police conduct an identification procedure. This can be a lineup where the victim is brought behind a one-way mirror and shown a number of people in person and asked if they recognize the person who victimized them. Other times, an identification is conducted via a photo array, which was done in this case. A photo array identification happens when the police put a series of photographs on a piece of paper, just headshots typically. They don't include names, ages, or any identifying information about any of the people on the page. One photo will be of the subject, and the rest will be what are called fillers, who roughly resemble the subject. The victim is asked to flip through the pages until he or she can identify the person who attacked them. It seems common sense that the fillers used in a photo array need to be people completely unrelated to the incident. But the police didn't do that here. Magnum was shown photo array twice, between March 16th and March 21st. And the photo arrays consisted only of Duke lacrosse players. Not only did this clearly violate Durham County Police procedures, but it completely tainted the procedure. Let's pull the thread on this idea a little bit. Magnum claims that she was assaulted by several members of the lacrosse team. When she is shown a photo array, only players are on the pages. Rather than seeing if she can identify a specific subject, any person who she points to then becomes a de facto criminal. There is no possibility of her misidentifying someone, as any person could theoretically have been at the party and attacked her. Still, when shown the photographs, she identified first Seligman as somebody who was at the party, but not somebody who attacked her. She saw the photo of Evans twice, but did not identify him. In fact, there was only one person that Magnum identified in each photo array procedure as having been at the party, and he was not one of the three who was arrested. And the reason for this is that he provided concrete proof that during the night of the party, he was at his girlfriend's, out of town. Photo arrays are very frequently used at trial. They can be an incredibly effective tool for a victim to demonstrate that their story is credible. If a victim is faced with a series of photographs where only one person is the potential attacker, and that person is picked out, it makes it far more likely that the event happened the way the victim is describing it. Without an identification procedure, it can be very hard to link a suspect to an incident. After the initial failures of Magnum to identify any attacker, she was brought back approximately 10 days later, and shown individual photos of every player on the lacrosse team. This time, she identified Finnerty and Seligman quickly, and upon going through the photos a second and a third time, eventually identified Evans, leading to the three players getting arrested. Seligman's family immediately hired an attorney who produced ATM receipts, photographs, cell phone tower records, and an affidavit from a taxi driver, as well as a swipe card log showing that his identification card was used to gain entry to his dorm prior to the time that Magnum claimed she was attacked. He also submitted photographs of Magnum from the beginning of the party, showing that the minor injuries which she claimed she sustained during the attack were actually present at the time she arrived first at the house. This was all ignored. Seligman was indicted with Finnerty and Evans based on Magnum's testimony and the faulty identification. There were two main facets of this case which led to the exoneration of the Duke lacrosse students. They're related, but independent, and each should really be taken as a cautionary tale. We're going to first discuss Magnum's credibility issues, and then we're going to go into the rampant misconduct of Mike Nifong and the Durham County District Attorney's Office. You don't need to be a lawyer to understand that in any case, but especially when the complaint is a sex crime, the credibility of the victim is vitally important. Sex crimes often boil down to a he said, she said situation where competing stories are weighed and a determination is made about essentially who's more believable. Initially, Magnum was widely believed. It seems she had no reason to make up an allegation like this, and she was backed up by Roberts, the other exotic dancer. Roberts had always maintained that she never personally observed the assault, but that she was aware that it happened. We talked very briefly earlier about Magnum ending up at the hospital complaining of rape shortly after the incident, but now let's talk through how exactly she got there. Magnum and Roberts left the party together. Roberts made the 911 call, which, again, did not mention any assault. But shortly after they left, Magnum and Roberts began to argue. Roberts tried to force Magnum out of her car. Magnum refused to leave. Roberts then drove to a 24-hour supermarket and approached a security guard, asking for help removing Magnum from her car. When that failed, the guard called 911, and Magnum again refused to leave. She also refused to speak to the police, was largely incoherent, and had no identification. As a result, she was removed to Durham Center Access, a facility for people with substance abuse and mental health issues. It was there where she claimed she had been sexually assaulted and was transferred to the Duke Hospital. Later on, Roberts was interviewed again, months later. She claimed under oath that she and Magnum had only been separated for maybe a maximum of 5 minutes, and that her claims of being sexually assaulted were, quote, a crock, end quote. And when she was first interviewed by police, Magnum claimed that she had been raped by 20 men. Later, she reduced that number to 3 when she was looking through the photographs. And that was not the only change to Magnum's story. In fact, it was documented that every single time she was asked, several key details changed. The time of the attack changed. Where it took place in the house changed. Even the actions of particular people were different when she spoke to different people. Initially, when questioned about her sexual activity, Magnum told investigators that the only intercourse she had had on March 13, 2006, was that forced upon her by the lacrosse players. But the Duke University Medical Center had given her a rape kit, and the results did not corroborate that story. We'll get into the DNA results when we talk about law enforcement issues. Magnum had also lied about her past. She indicated that she had never been in trouble with the law before, but in reality, she had stolen a taxicab in 2002, leading police on a high-speed chase, nearly striking an officer, and only stopping after she collided with a patrol car. Every victim of a crime deserves justice, and there's obviously no rule that says if you've broken laws in the past, that law enforcement should not help you if you're victimized in the future. But when a person's entire case rests on whether people should believe what they're saying happened, every lie, no matter how seemingly irrelevant, gives detectives and prosecutors some pause, because it ultimately will give a judge or jury some pause. I cannot stress enough the lengths which detectives and prosecutors will typically go to in order to convey to crime victims that they absolutely must be direct and honest, even if it means admitting to doing something they're not proud of or even illegal. In my experience, it's always made clear to victims that they are not in trouble, but that in order to fully prosecute an offender, a truly accurate portrayal of the incident is absolutely paramount. One of the biggest reasons that sex crime prosecutions fail is that the victim is shown to have lied. Defense attorneys will latch on to every inconsistency given and make what is called a falsus in uno, falsus in omnibus claim. This means that the defense lawyer will tell the jury that if they find the victim lied about one thing, no matter how immaterial, they are free to disregard any or all of that victim's testimony. It's a powerful weapon for a lawyer to be able to highlight that the jury cannot credit the testimony of someone who has shown a willingness to lie. And since a defendant cannot be forced to take the stand, the prosecutor frequently does not get the opportunity to make a similar claim. Now let's dig into what went wrong from the law enforcement angle. At so many levels, police and prosecutors violated their own policies, hid evidence, lied about what they were doing, and disregarded significant red flags, which would have given a reasonable law enforcement agency pause. You've heard me mention the name Mike Nifong. He was the Durham County District Attorney, and he became the lead investigator. Normally, the investigation would be solely conducted by the Durham Police Department, and the District Attorney's Office would have been consulted on things like search warrants or other avenues that would require judicial intervention, but the nuts and bolts would have been under the control of the PD. That didn't happen here. Nifong took control of everything. He directed the entire investigation. It's widely speculated, though, as a disclaimer, there is no concrete proof that this is actually true, so take it with a grain of salt, but a lot of people have expressed the thought that in March 2006, Mike Nifong was in a very tough re-election campaign. He needed a big public win to advance his standing, and he latched on to this as a way to enhance his political career. Again, this is purely speculative, but if true, it would provide some insight into why he did certain things. For example, at the end of March 2006, while the investigation was still relatively in its infancy, prior to any arrests being made, Nifong gave over 50 press conferences and interviews, giving his own opinion about a crime having been committed and alleging that the students were all refusing to cooperate. Now let's talk about the most egregious misconduct right off the bat. You've all seen enough movies and television to know that in rape cases, DNA can be a powerful piece of evidence for either the prosecution or the defense. In a good number of cases, the reporting or outcry comes with a delay such that any DNA evidence would no longer be present. But in this case, the report was made just a short time after Magnum claimed the incident occurred, and a rape kit was given that night, before Magnum had showered or even changed her clothes. So this is exactly the type of case where if a rape had occurred, one could expect to find DNA evidence. Of course, there are other reasons that DNA evidence might not be present, but in the absence of those reasons, one would expect to find it. The North Carolina State Crime Lab examined the DNA samples provided from the rape kit against the samples taken from every single Duke lacrosse team player. Not a single match was identified. It should be noted that this also took place prior to the April 18, 2006 arrests of Finnerty, Seligman, and Evans. Nifong then decided to send the DNA to a second DNA testing facility, a private company called DNA Security Inc., or DSI. DSI compared DNA taken from Magnum's fake fingernails, recovered from the bathroom trash can, and determined that 2% of the male population could not be excluded from DNA lifted from those fingernails. Evans was one of the 2% who could not be excluded. Here is where the prosecution made a massive ethical violation. Brian Meehan, the director of DSI, issued an initial report to Mike Nifong. In this report, Meehan stated that the rape kit actually revealed DNA from several individuals, but that none of the DNA matched any of the players, including Evans, and that those results were conclusive. Nifong instructed Meehan to omit this information from the report that would be turned over to the defense and to the court. Meehan did so. Since 1963, there has been a tenet of criminal law applicable to every jurisdiction in America that a prosecutor is required to turn over exculpatory evidence that he or she has in their possession. This comes from a landmark case called Brady v. Maryland. When a prosecutor fails to do this, a Brady violation occurs. If it's intentional, it is a massive ethical violation for a prosecutor and can result in significant penalties, including disbarment and maybe even more. The DNA results here clearly showed that Magnum had indeed had sexual intercourse recently before her rape kit, but none of the Duke players were the source of the genetic material. This was also significant because Magnum had told investigators that she had not had intercourse with anyone else, when in fact the rape kit collected sources from several individuals. Not only did Nifong fail to turn this information over to the defense attorneys, he lied to the judge overseeing the case about it, telling the judge that the results were something different than what they actually were. And the truth didn't come out until a December 2006 pretrial hearing where Meehan was on the stand. After intense grilling by attorneys for the students, he eventually admitted that the true results were what they actually were and stated under oath that he had been instructed by Nifong to scrub the results from the report and not to tell anyone about it. This answer actually caused observers in the gallery to stand up and applaud for the defense attorneys who had finally managed to get to the truth. And this was also exceptionally significant because Nifong had been claiming that scientific evidence had corroborated Magnum's story, and he made it a centerpiece of his prosecution, even while knowing that the DNA evidence from the rape kit excluded each and every player. Within a week, Nifong dropped the rape charges against the three students, but retained the sexual assault and kidnapping charges. Shortly after that, the North Carolina bar filed ethics charges against Nifong for his conduct. In response, Nifong bowed to mounting pressure and in mid-January 2007 asked Attorney General Roy Cooper to take over the investigation. 2 weeks later, the North Carolina bar filed a second round of comprehensive ethics violations against Nifong. Cooper's office undertook a thorough review of all the evidence collected. They dropped all remaining charges against the three players. But Cooper's office actually went a step further and declared that the players were factually innocent. I can't stress to you enough that this is almost never done. Typically, when a prosecutor drops charges, the most they will say is that their office lacked the evidence to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. They very, very rarely actually declare the defendant or defendants factually innocent of the allegations. Mike Nifong was disbarred by the state of North Carolina in June 2007. He also served a day in jail for criminal contempt relating to his deliberate misrepresentations in court about the DNA evidence. At the end of the day, Mike Nifong was the only person in this entire case who spent any time in jail. In summation, in addition to always having the burden of proof in a criminal trial, prosecutors also have an incredibly high standard for ethical considerations in how they handle their cases. The job cannot be solely about convictions at the expense of justice. Mike Nifong represents a hyperbolic example of what happens when a prosecutor abandons a duty to pursue the fair distribution of justice and simply attempts to persecute criminal defendants regardless of facts. I honestly don't know if this was just a way to try and win a re-election or if there was something else at play, but what he did crossed virtually every line set up to ensure that the government does not overreach against people accused of crimes and violate their rights. Fortunately for Evans, Finnerty, and Seligman, they came from affluent families who could afford lawyers that would hammer away at the inconsistencies and obscured evidence. Not everyone accused with a crime has that luxury. Evans, who was a senior at the time, graduated from Duke. But Finnerty and Seligman both withdrew. A few years ago, on the 10-year anniversary of the case, interviews were conducted of both Finnerty and Seligman. They both said that the stigma of the case has hounded them throughout the years. They still encounter people who believe them to be rapists, despite being cleared and completely exonerated by the Attorney General. One final thought. Sexual violence is awful, and those who commit it should absolutely be prosecuted. Every person who makes such an accusation has the right to be heard and to have their claim evaluated. But it diminishes those victims who have actually suffered horrific acts when people make false accusations based on anger or retaliation. While making these false claims is a crime, it's rarely ever prosecuted, and it wasn't in this case. But the harm that it does to society by feeding the fervor of those people whose natural inclination is to disbelieve is severe. Crystal Magnum has never come clean about fabricating these allegations. That's the show for this week. Thank you, as always, to Dan Townsend, my audio engineer and brother. And thank you for those of you who emailed me to talk about Dread Pirate Roberts after the last episode, shared your thoughts and feelings on him. I really do appreciate it. If you like the show, please rate it and review it, as that helps other people find it. If you have feedback you want to share with me, you can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at InsummationPod, or you can find me via my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. If you have any cases you'd like to suggest or any issues that you would like to hear a little bit about, maybe an explanation, feel free to let me know and I'll do my best to either incorporate them into an episode or just respond to you. I want to say again, thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more. Woo-hoo!